All right, hello everybody. Welcome to another episode of Transfigured. I'm here with Malcolm Collins, and Malcolm is a fun and unique guy. I first sort of heard your ideas when you were on Chris Williamson's channel, and then yeah. I got to know you. I feel like even better, you and your wife Simone, when you were on Paul Vanderclay's channel. My channel's highly correlated with Paul Vanderclay's channel in terms of interests and audience, and you were talking about things that I just found really fascinating. So let's sort of dive right into it. Let's talk about birth rates. What's going on with birth rates and what's the news there?
People have no idea how bad the situation is right now or how much it's transformed. Even since I've done the Chris Williamson show, basically the entire ecosystem has completely transformed. So when I was on his show, the story was basically, look, falling fertility rates is a real big issue. If you, you know, look at the last 10 years of falling fertility rates in the US and you project that going forward, then you assume one generation every 30 years, for every 100 Americans, there's going to be 4.3 great-grandchildren. In the UK, it's like 1.6. Like, it's bad. But, and a lot of people are like, oh, fix this with immigration. And what they don't realize is a lot of these countries that we're taking immigrants from also have very low fertility rates. So, for example, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean combined fell below repopulation rate all the way back in 2019. And this is by the UN's own statistics, which famously inflates this stuff. But I need to get to, like a few things have changed recently. The Latin American numbers are one that have changed pretty dramatically recently. I don't know if you can edit here. Hold on, I'm just gonna pull up because I really want to read a quote here about what's going on with Latin American fertility rates at the moment, because it's absolutely chilling how bad things have gotten. Okay, so as recently as 2019, a benchmark study by the United Nations Population Division for 2020 to 2100 forecast that fertility in Latin America and Caribbean countries would stabilize at an average of 1.75 children per woman in the latter half of the century. So they assumed, and this is what they keep assuming, that this fertility collapse is just going to magically stop all of a sudden, even though all the leading indicators show that it's going to get worse. Whether you're asking, you know, Gen Alpha about how many kids they want to have, or you look at rates of religiosity in Gen Alpha. But hold on, I'm going to continue with this quote. Stunningly, except for Mexico, all of the countries listed in this graph have already dropped below this level. Uruguay, Costa Rica, Chile, Jamaica, and Cuba now have fertility rates of around 1.3 children per woman, the so-called ultra-low fertility threshold that has been seen in only a handful of European and East Asian countries. So that means in a lot of these Latin American countries, you're basically having a population that's halving every year. The Latin America's fertility rate, like, as of now, is in a much worse situation than the United States' fertility rate. And a lot of people just didn't expect this. If you look at China, I think it's just since 2016, so just in the last 8 years, their fertility rate has dropped by 60%.
Mm-hmm. That's nuts. And like, China released their birth numbers like sometime last week, and they were even worse than like what people were expecting.
Yeah. So imagine, and it's leaked numbers. They didn't let this stuff come out knowingly, but so you're a daycare, right? Like just imagine what this means. Like, you have a number of schools or something like that. That means an incoming class in a few years, because you know, you've got to wait for these kids to grow up, is going to be 40% smaller than it would have been 8 years ago. Just like, this is at ultra crisis level. And a lot of people are like, well, what are you afraid of? Like, if they know Elon Musk complains about this, they're like, he's just afraid, because we talk about the economic impact of this. They're like, he's just afraid he won't have as much money. And it's like, no, he's going to have the same amount of money. Okay. I'm going to have the same amount of money. The people who are going to get screwed are your grandparents and anybody who is expecting a pension, because a lot of these pension plans, people don't realize it. Like, they think that the money's like saved. No, it comes from the next generation down the line.
Or directly. Any business that's based on having customers that buy things in abundance,
I don't want to get into the full thing. I'm just trying to go with the obvious stuff that everyone can realize, like Social Security is not going to work anymore. But like, our entire economic system is likely going to collapse. Now, if you want to go more into the Hispanic fertility rate numbers, we actually just released an episode of our podcast today on that subject. That's like Hispanics are going extinct or something. It is chilling. So a lot of people, you know, they're like, okay, we can't solve this with immigration. We can solve it by giving cash handouts. And it's like, that doesn't work. Hungary spent 5% of its GDP on this the year before, and they got their fertility rates up by like 1.6%, which is trivial when you're looking at like double-digit fertility rate declines in a lot of countries in the world right now, basically all over the world. You know, in China, you're looking at like 20% every year almost over some year periods.
So what's the cause of this? So we've got this in East Asia. It's in Europe in varying degrees, Latin America, the United States, North America, like perhaps sub-Saharan Africa is somewhat immune, but like why is this happening in all these different places at once? What is going on?
Sub-Saharan Africa isn't immune. They're following the same trend all countries follow, which is if the average citizen is earning less than 5,000 USD per year, the fertility rate's typically above replacement. If they're earning more than that, it's typically below replacement. And so it's not a developing world versus developed world thing. It's like a desperate daily fight for survival versus a developing world sort of thing. And you get this fertility collapse as soon as you enter a basic level of economic structure, which is what I consider like most of Latin America in.
So it seems almost backwards of what you'd expect. You would expect affluence, meaning like, well, I've got more money. I could invest more in more children. I don't need to worry about starvation. I can give them lots of stuff. But why is there such an inverse correlation between?
It is an inverse correlation even within countries. So like within the US, the more money you have, the less kids you have until you get to like extreme amounts of wealth, like over $1 million a year in household income. It's actually over $500,000 a year is when you begin to get above repopulation rate again, but it doesn't really matter. Like so small a percent of the population is above those numbers.
So you're saying there's hope. If we can just get average GDP per capita above $500,000 a year,
So realistically, what a lot of cultural groups do that stay above repopulation rate is they artificially sort of harm the economic productivity of their group members because that increases the fertility and allows their group to outcompete neighboring groups population weight wise. We're talking about like cultural evolution, but you're saying, why did this happen? Okay. So the core reason is it used to be that, and when I say used to be, I mean like three generations ago. People don't realize how quickly society has changed. For the vast majority of the world, it was like 2 to 3 generations ago. The more kids you had, the more wealth you had. These were more people you could have work in a factory. These were more people you had working on the farm. Now, the more kids you have, the less wealth you have. And it's pretty dramatic to the extent where like, and society adapted to this over time. So I was interviewing my dad recently about what it was like for him growing up. And he was talking about how like in starting in middle school, so he was like 6, he would walk 1.5 miles to school and back. If you had a 6-year-old walking 1.5 miles to school and back, like one, that'd be so much easier if I could do that with my kids, just walk to school, right? Like it would be so much easier to have more kids, but like the governing system and our social expectations don't allow you to do that. So the temporal cost of raising kids has increased pretty dramatically, but the fact that the less money you have, the more kids you have somewhat explains part of the key to all of this. So there's two keys to this. One is more kids lower your quality of life now. And so what that means is that you need some exogenous motivator to have above 2 kids. Like you may gain among some portion of this population, like maybe 40% of people like gain satisfaction, enough satisfaction from having kids, like having 2 kids is worth it. But like going to 5 or 6 kids isn't worth it. And 40% of your population having 2 kids is gonna keep you well under repopulation rate. You need about 1/3 of any population. Like, okay, so if 1/3 of a population is having no kids and 1/3 is having 2 kids, for that population to stay stable, the final 1/3 has to have over 4 kids. And basically no one's having over 4 kids these days outside of religious communities, but we'll talk about that in a second. The other problem is that the economic system is really good at differentially pricing the value of each individual's work. So what I mean by that is capitalism. I'm a capitalist. Like I think it's an efficient system, but it has one really big drawback is that it is systemically incapable of thinking long term. And what this means is if it sees a productive individual, it's basically asking itself and not like, you know, thinking, but it's like, what's the minimum amount I need to pay to get this person working versus doing anything else with their life? i.e. being at home with their family, being with kids, etc. And so the more economic productivity you have the potential of having within the system, the more the system's going to pay you to not do those other things, which is going to, and this is why ultra wealthy families have a higher fertility rate. Because when you get above like $500,000 in household income, you're really not playing in the economic system anymore that everyone else is playing in. And you're really not working for the incremental dollar anymore, which then allows you to disassociate from the economic system in the same way somebody earning under 5,000 USD per year is dissociated from the economic system.
Right. And how much of that do you think it is that it enables stay-at-home moms once you have
a very for fertility rates. We could get deep into this, but there's this huge myth that there used to be a bunch of stay-at-home moms. This is not true. In the 1950s, Hollywood was just as insidious as Hollywood today. They had just as much of an agenda to be pushing as Hollywood today. And they pushed this ideal of the stay-at-home wife lifestyle that was not practiced in large numbers anywhere in the world except for small, affluent pockets of the United States, period. And a lot of people are like, well, why can't we go back to when the U.S., when we had all this money and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, we had all this money because we basically stole it from the rest of the world in a post-World War II, like worldwide economic collapse, except for us. And a lot of people, there's these magical graphs that they'll pull up, and we'll do an episode on this someday, where they're like, in 1972, something happened. Like, the amount of wealth that the middle income earner in the US was earning basically flatlines in terms of purchasing power. But the amount of wealth that the managerial class in the US is making continues to go up, right? And they're like, what's going on here? Well, there's a simple graph you can overlay this with, which is decline in worldwide poverty. And it's a direct correlation. What actually happened was outsourcing. That money, all of those gains in productivity are being enjoyed by people who aren't starving to death every day all over the world. And the people who are managing them are still the managerial class in the United States. So what really happened was, is as we begin to lift the rest of the world out of poverty, and when I say the rest of the world, I'm talking about Europe. I'm talking about Japan. I'm not talking about like Africa or something like that. These countries were in desperate poverty after World War II. It made this economic system of the stay-at-home wife like an ultra luxury now, even within the United States, to not have two incomes to a family. And so people are like, well, how did families used to make this work? And they used to do what we call the corporate relationship. And the corporate relationship is typically when the husband and wife work together, which is what me and my wife do. And I think that we're seeing people begin to move back towards this in this more gig economy system. So they would have, maybe a house business around blacksmithery. Like if you were a blacksmith, it didn't mean your wife did nothing. She wasn't a stay-at-home wife. She would do stuff tied to the blacksmithing business. If you were making clothes, your wife didn't do nothing. She was there sewing, and so were your kids. And that was the economic system that was sustainable. Now we might find new economic systems that are sustainable for large families, but I want to get to the other thing. This is how we're going to tie all this into religion. Which is to say, okay, you need some externality above kids make me happy to have more than two kids at sustainable rates. The core externality that's providing that in the world today are religious systems. That's just it. Every country, they go, we do consulting and stuff like that. They'll go, oh, how do I get fertility rates up? I'm like, oh, you have high fertility populations in your country, and you can utilize them to grow your country. Because, if you can, as I say, like if I have eight kids and they have eight kids and we do that for just 11 generations, I'll have more descendants than live on Earth today. It does not take long for high fertility groups to correct this problem. And they're like, oh, this is amazing. We do have high fertility groups. And they're like, can you show me where these high fertility groups are? And I'm like, yeah, they're your conservative religious population, and you need to stop taking their kids.
Stop trying to convert their kids into the urban monoculture, as you call it.
Yeah, the urban monoculture, as we say, you're deconverting their kids into the urban monoculture, and they're like, but if we do that, then the urban monoculture ceases to exist, and progressive ceases to exist because we have like the lowest fertility rate of any group in the world, and I'm like, yeah, that's a problem. It's a problem that your cultural strategy, if you're looking at this like at the mimetic level, if you look at how like cultures evolve and everything, is entirely parasitic and dependent on nearby demographically healthy cultural groups. Now, the fertility collapse in Latin America is actually really interesting, and it's something I want to talk about because it's top of mind because I was just editing that episode today.
Go for it. Go for it.
So a lot of people assume that, okay, well, then we just need to go back to the old ways. And there's sort of two problems with this. One, these old systems, when they used to work, they were working in a completely different social and economic circumstance. And a lot of these old systems are falling apart right now in terms of fertility rate. Yeah. Like Mormons doubled their population rate like 5-6 years ago. And they're reacting differently to this. Like different cultural traditions, different religious traditions react to prosperity differently and decline at fertility at different rates. The weakest by far, the ones that struggle the most are East Asian traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and their forms of atheism that they have over there in like China and stuff like that do terribly, just terrible fertility rates. The probably the next worst in terms of fertility rates is a tie between, and this is going to really surprise people, between Catholics and Muslims. People are like, Muslims have high fertility rates. It's like, no, Muslims don't have high fertility rates. Muslims are just poorer. And because of that, they have higher fertility rates. But when they achieve wealth, their fertility declines pretty dramatically. Catholics, people are like, isn't the Catholic stereotype that Catholics have tons of kids? Average Catholic majority country in Europe right now. Remember I said all these countries have a 1.3 average fertility rate in Latin America? It's 1.3 as well in Europe. They're some of the lower fertility countries.
What about if you within say a Catholic country like Italy or Spain or something like that, if you slice by church attendance, do you see any difference or something like that? Are people who are more devout more fertile than otherwise?
Within a country, the more conservative a group is, the more kids they have. But between countries, and anyone who wants to look up our Arya Babu interview, because she did a really interesting study on this that showed the more conservative on average a country was in Europe, specifically she was looking at questions like it is bad for like a woman's primary job is to have kids, or women should like directly correlated with childbirth. There's actually an inverse correlation between the average prevalence of these beliefs in a country and the fertility rate of that country. So the more conservative a country is on average, the lower their fertility rate is. And people are like, that's weird. What's going on there? And this is the same phenomenon where, and I suspect what's going on here is the same phenomenon. The more immigrants you have in a country, like the more diverse a country is, the higher the native population's fertility rate. This often really confuses people. They're like, whoa. Like if you, for example, took all of the Hispanic population and kicked them out of our country, the United States fertility rate would crash of native-born Americans. People are like, that makes no sense. And I'm like, just look at the data, look around the world. All of the mono-ethnic countries, like South Korea, for example, they're the countries with the lowest fertility rate. The countries that are prosperous but have been able to maintain a high fertility rate, like are countries like the United States and Israel, which are uniquely diverse countries. So I think what it actually
does that foster a sense of like intergroup competition that people maybe feel consciously or subconsciously? Yeah.
So being a conservative, living in a system that you feel is actively attacking you, increases your conservative in a system that you feel is on your side actually decreases your fertility rate. And for very interesting reasons in these Catholic countries. So this is another thing that we can get into because it's just fascinating to me. So we can actually pinpoint exactly what caused the Catholic country's fertility collapse. And what it turns out is they had actually already undergone the demographic collapse that a lot of other countries have undergone, which is the children that people wanted were collapsing. What's changed recently in these countries, and you can find this in the Latin American data set, is that almost all of the kids who should have been entering the world that aren't now are from people between the ages of 15 and 24. So they were very young, unintended pregnancies. The core thing that's changed is that now contraceptives and everything like that. And we talk about how good different cultures are at enforcing their values. Catholicism is famously like really bad at enforcing like values around contraceptive practices and everything like that when contrast with other cultures that have similar belief systems. And because of that, they now have widespread use of contraceptives in these countries. And that, especially among youth. And so these unintended pregnancies aren't happening. And people are like, oh, you must think that's a horrible thing. And I'm like, no, that's a good thing. Like when we talk about what needs to happen in Africa and what needed to happen in Latin America is we need to stop keeping our fertility rates high by forcing children on people who didn't plan on having children and who don't want children, and instead find ways to socially motivate, you know, economically productive people in the years where you really probably should be having kids, which is like 20 to 30 or 35, to be having a lot of kids. And so, you know, now we can start focusing within Latin America and within our own country, motivating people to have kids within the window where it's economically and societally useful for these individuals to have kids.
Sure. So it's not, when you look at the success of religious groups, you have to look at two things. You can't just look at fertility rates of one generation. You have to look at also how many of those children stay faithful to that tradition, and then, you know, intergenerational fertility. Like, because if you have a religious group that has a really high fertility rate, but all their kids deconvert and then return to below replacement fertility rates, that's really not going to make much of a difference.
Oh, absolutely.
You need a religion that both has high fertility and high intergenerational fidelity, and which groups are sort of able to do that?
You see, we talk about this a lot in our book, and we do a lot of math around this because obviously this allows for a lot of math. We call this intergenerational bleed or a religion's bleed rate. Mm-hmm. So Eight Passengers is a great example of like completely dropping the ball. Anyone who's familiar with the Eight Passengers situation, it was this conservative, I think Mormon mom who had really strict discipline with her kids. And she had six kids seven kids. The kids ended up basically all leaving the faith, all hating her. It was so bad that when one kid would leave the house, and she was like a famous influencer, so like a lot of people were copying her styles. Like a lot of religiously conservative people thought this was the correct strategy. One kid would leave the household and they basically like set up like a shop that was around deconverting the kids later in line from their own family. And I've watched interviews from these kids. We've done a video on this. I think it was the one where we called like Girl Defined is Ruining an Entire Generation. Oh, actually, no, we didn't end up publishing the Eight Passengers video because we thought it was too spiteful. The kid clearly has, if you watch videos on it, it's very clear. He regularly sees a psychologist and has implanted memories, because he has all the hallmarks of implanted memories of abuse, which is something we often talk about, the cult of psychology on our thing. I'm trained in psychology. I can spot these things really quickly. And the modern psychological practice has become like really toxic. But anyway, so intergenerational bleed, who can do it well? The single group that does it best of any group in the world right now by a huge margin is the Amish. I'd say the Amish and conservative Jews. So we can talk about both of these groups. Why do the Amish do such a good job? I actually think Rumspringa is the reason why. If you want to see like a really bad system and one that's really failed recently, Mormons, their bleed rate has gotten pretty, really high recently. And the reason is because their strategy when a kid is most likely to deconvert is during their teenage years, right? Like when they're going through this rebellious phase. So what Mormonism does is they basically assign a minder to them, and then they leave their social group and they're just Mormon everything all the time, always being supervised, right? Well, it turns out what did the collapse of Mormonism coincide with? The popularity of internet-enabled cell phones. As soon as these kids engage with online apologetics and everything like that, they started deconverting en masse because Mormonism just logically doesn't hold up very well to like reality.
It doesn't do well under the spotlight of investigation.
At least the form of Mormonism that most people are taught. We have our video, Are We Mormons? Actual Mormon theology is much more sophisticated, but most Mormons don't grow up learning actual Mormon theology because it's weird. And Mormons have like a huge fear of looking weird or looking like not normal Christians. And because of that, they have undergone a process of Catholicization, partially because a huge portion of their new converts are from Catholic majority countries. And they have this idea of a central church. So they just bring a lot of these concepts over. Anyway, so Mormons do really bad. Amish do the opposite. They take kids during the years when you're most likely to deconvert. And they're like, yeah, go, leave. Do your own thing. You know, this is Rumspringa. Leave the community if you want to leave. Drink all you want to drink. You know, go out there, whore all you want to whore. And kids really quickly realize that, oh, going out there and indulging in hedonism doesn't give me what my community gives me. Like, clearly they understand something that keep in mind, these communities, they're not like they have their fingers on the scale a bit. You know, these communities, kids aren't fully educated.
Well,
like a normal
Amish and really Orthodox Jewish communities have a really strong, thick community sense. And a lot of their enforcement is through sort of like shame and sort of collective, guilt and that sort of thing. And, well, and your life is so thickly tied, intertied with the community. And anyone who grows up with that, you take that away, it feels like you're, you know, everything underneath you is gone and you want to go back to it. But they're very highly isolationist with both of those two communities.
They are, but I actually think you touched on something here. When they punish a kid in ultra-Orthodox Judaism or in Amish communities for leaving the community or for going against community standards, it is done with whatever you want to call it, shame. Like the person didn't live up to their cultural standards. Now contrast this with what a lot of the Christian communities that are really bleeding do. They punish kids with physical corporal punishment. And one of the things we talk about in one of our episodes of, you know, why we're seeing this collapse of religion right now, we have an episode on this, is a lot of these evangelical parents I talk to, they'll be like, oh, my kid, you know, knows better than to like break from the faith in this way or say, I don't believe X or Y. And I'm like, well, when you say they know better, what you mean is if you knew that they didn't believe this stuff anymore, you would punish them. So what you have created is a system where as your kids deconvert, they are not communicating this to you. They are not telling this to you. And I know a lot of kids from evangelical families. I actually say the majority of kids I know to evangelical families have actually secretly deconverted and just haven't told their parents. Because a lot of parents think that what they're going to see when their kids deconvert is like a loud, angry deconversion or anger with the church
or obvious signs of changed behavior. Yeah,
exactly.
Like dying the hair, getting tattoos, or, you know, whatever you want to call
it. Yeah, no. The kids I know, captain, like head of his fraternity, head of his sports team, you know, absolute clear cut, you know, straight A students, you know, and they've all deconverted. What it means is a lot of these systems, like when we talk about going back to the old ways, one of the things you used to have within Christian communities is if a kid deconverted, the community would inform the parents or was beginning to deconvert. Like even me being somebody who was raised by atheistic parents and I was growing up, it was known I wasn't a Christian. And this was reported to my grandmother, right? Like by the local community, right? Like, and so they were just real, like, clear lines of communication on this stuff. Now you actually have the opposite happening, where you have social enforcement, but it's around the urban monoculture. If you show any immunity, if you show any resistance to it, they'll tell your parents, did you know that, like, little Johnny has naughty views X and Y? Which is really, yeah. And so the question is, how do you
solve it? Or the public school teacher won't tell the parents that they're slowly starting to change and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, you've seen the things where they've like built list of kids that they think they might be able to convince to become trans. For like these lists have leaked.
I hope that that's a rare thing, but I have seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. No. With a lot of this stuff, I think is much more common than people think. I think that people, you know, when I talk about like a 60% fertility drop in the last 6 years in some of these countries, in some of these Hispanic countries, it was even worse than that. But I don't want to, because I don't know if you edit your episodes, but in one of mine, I just take the time to find the quote from that article. But, you know, it's something like 40% drop in the past 4 years in one of these countries or something. Like, it's insane. I think that was Argentina. But anyway, in Costa Rica had a similar drop recently. But anyway, so this is not a gradual change. This is not like what you experienced when you were in school, but a bit worse. This is a completely new phenomenon. When you send your kids into the public school these days, you are sending them into a brainwashing factory. That's just it. And it is an effective brainwashing factory because it's the only way that they can keep their existing population of the urban monoculture stable because their fertility rates are so low. What are the alternatives? Well, the Collins Institute, one of our main philanthropic efforts right now, we hope to go live, like I'm just working on it before this, Q1 this year, will be an alternative to the public school at a very low cost. So with a lot of this stuff, we're looking at like, how can we create low cost alternatives that aren't brainwashing factories? It's tough.
So a question that I wanted to ask you about is how do we how would we design religions that were up to this challenge, that don't have the problem of too much bleed, that are able to give that sort of higher sense of meaning and satisfaction around having families, and that are compelling and attractive and aren't just simply using corporal punishment or something like that as a way to get things going, but perhaps maybe not also just going the full Amish. So what are the characteristics that a religion needs to have to withstand this?
Yeah, well, so one, on the full Amish category, the two dominant strategies today for staying high fertility as a cultural group are either technological disengagement or reducing the economic productivity of group members. Both of those things increase fertility rates within groups. What's critical about this is it means that most of the world's population is going to come from groups engaging in these practices of the future, which means if you're from a group that is technologically engaged in high economic productivity, and you can maintain even just like a moderately good fertility rate, you will have a disproportionate level of control when it comes to the future of the human species. Because there are very, very few groups that are like this in the world today. So the prize is you win humanity. You win the great game of civilization if you can figure this out.
You get to inherit the earth, as someone might have said.
Very quickly you can replace the other groups. And the groups that you don't replace aren't relevant because they're not technologically capable or economically productive. And when we say economically productive, I don't mean like they earn money. I mean they can afford things like tanks and helicopters and nuclear plants and stuff like that. Anyway, and genetics research, which is something that my family has always criticized for, but it's something that people are going to need to get realistic about sooner or later. How do you do it? Well, we wrote a book on this, The Pragmatist's Guide to Crafting Religion. It's very nuanced and it's a very personal thing. So one of the stances that we always try to take is our job isn't to convert people to my family's weird belief system. If you want to learn about that, we have a playlist on our YouTube channel that's like our weird Malmones, weird religious beliefs that just goes over our videos on this subject. And then people are like, why don't you want to just convert people to your family's weird system? And it's like, well, because we want more diversity. Like, by that, when we mean diversity is like our family is one hypothesis about how we thread this particular needle or archway in human history. But that hypothesis is likely to fail. And if it does fail, I need people trying other experiments that are still enabling high economic productivity and high technological engagement, humanity to continue to thrive. Because these Amish, they're not getting on spaceships or going to the stars. They're not going to be, and keep in mind, when we're talking about like, even if you, it's only like 10% of the world's population who falls into these high fertility, yet economically engaged and technologically productive groups. These are the people who will eventually be boarding spaceships and make up the vast majority of humans throughout all of human history, because they'll be the ones colonizing the stars. They'll be the iteration of humanity that ends up mattering. So how do you do this? Well, we can talk
about- So how do you do this? High technological capability, high levels of education and productivity, above average replacement rate, intergenerational transmission of belief system. That seems like the holy grail, and it doesn't seem like too many people are grasping at it now. So how do you get there?
We have an episode coming out this Friday that I'm really going to go into this in a lot more detail than any of the other episodes we've done on this, which is how to keep our kids from falling out of our religion. I was talking to you a bit about this beforehand, but I was looking at like, why did my dad leave the church? Cause I'm like, okay, if I'm trying to bring my kids back to the church, I need to know why my family, like my genetic line, like personality traits are heritable. They'll be just as likely to leave the church for the reason my dad did. And it was because when he was a kid in Sunday school, he questioned the logistics of the Noah's Ark story. Like how could all the animals get there? Even if they were babies, they would grow over this time period. And if magic was being used, why would it not say that magic was being used? That seems like a huge oversight. Going through all of this, and he got punished for this. And he's like, look, I'm not going to be in any cultural tradition that punishes me for asking what are, to me, very reasonable questions. And if I brought my kids back to one of the faiths, they would be kicked out for the same reason, right? And so I was like, well, the problem is people are like, well, not all Christians. Some Christians will be like, oh, that's just like metaphors or old stories. But the problem is that the iterations of Christianity that loosen the doctrinal interpretations around this stuff end up loosening doctrinal interpretations when they clash with the urban monoculture across the board. And I don't want that. I don't want some loosey-goosey church. I want a church that is sane, but also very strict in terms of what it expects from an individual. And so what you need is you need some logically consistent, like if you're staying within the Christian faith, which, you know, my family is, if you're staying within the or the larger Judeo-Christian tree, I guess you could say, if you're staying within the Judeo-Christian tree, you need some metric or some sort of framing device for what you are throwing out and adapting and what you aren't throwing out and adapting that is not what fits what society says is good today and what society says is wrong today. Mm-hmm. And so we've built this within our own family sort of framework for how we do that. But we've also built frameworks around what is God that are much harder to disprove from a secular, not disprove because you know, you can't disprove God, but they are much more plausible from a secular understanding of reality. And we also go through in this video, we're going to release all of the major problems that the Judeo-Christian faith has right now in terms of, because a lot of people think people deconvert from the tradition because they want to sin. Like they want to go out and do drugs and stuff like that.
There's some of that, but that's not the main reason. Yeah.
That's not the main reason. Usually it's logical inconsistency. And then they start engaging with that stuff to justify their decision because they realize after they leave, they're not any happier. But usually the thing that first drives them out is something like the good God problem. Like Christianity pretends they have good solutions to this problem. They really don't. The good God problem is, you know, the how can God be both all powerful and all good? And yet, and people be like, well, maybe all suffering has a purpose. It's like, no, very obviously we live in a world where some suffering, you know, little kids dying of diseases before they're even born or, you know, animals eating each other alive, like some cruelty just seems like objectively unnecessary for me living a good life. There are ways that this could have been done differently. And so that's a huge problem. And you could try to work around this, but it's a big problem. Another one that I think Christians really do not focus on enough, and it's a huge, huge problem for my book, which is you cannot have a totalizing religion with a local revelation that includes miracles. Let me explain what I mean by this. You can't have a religion that is meant to apply to every human that will ever be born that had a local revelation, i.e. like Jesus revealing the whole thing 2,000 years ago.
Jesus, Moses, Abraham, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, what about the Native Americans who wouldn't hear this story for another 1,000 years? What about the people in the British Isles? What about the people in China? This is actually what motivated the creation of Mormonism, was trying to answer this very question, because it just seems so, because like, and this is why I say if and miracles. Like if this religion didn't include miracles, if Jesus didn't perform miracles, I'd be like, okay, fine. Like they just the logistics, they could only reveal this in one place at a time. But Jesus,
so why couldn't Jesus have also gone to the Native Americans, right?
Yeah, if he's out there raising people from the dead, why can't he teleport? And and much less, this guy died at like 35 or something. Like, and he knew he was going to die. He knew he was marching into his death when he did the whole thing with the temple. Why not like take a 20-year break to get on a ship and go to China, go to the UK, then come back and then do your whole knocking over tables at the temple thing? You would have dramatically increased the rate at which people got this information. And so if you're doing some miracles, you know, you need a system that explains that. And so we go through all of this as a family and we try to come up with ways that we can restructure aspects or ways of interpreting aspects of the tradition that are very strict to older faith systems.
So what you're saying is that a key ingredient of a religion that will work is intellectual plausibility.
Yeah. Which is something that I think a lot of religions right now, they're like, well, just have faith. And it's like, well, just have faith doesn't work when you're choosing between multiple religious systems. Like, just have faith in Islam. Just have faith in, you know, Catholicism. Just have faith in, like, Judaism. Like, all of these groups have just as much claim to the just have faith argument. Or they'll say, oh, well, the Bible predicted things in the future. Well, people say the Quran predicted things in the future. You know, you've got to look at the apologetics that the other side is doing. So you need a system of argumentation. So what I could go deep into sort of how we develop this system as a family. The broad strokes are we tell our kids, you know, 100,000 years from now, 1,000,000 years from now, if humans still exist, do you think they'd be closer to the way you would interpret a human today or closer to the way you'd interpret a deity today? And I think most reasonable secular people would say in 100,000 years, in 1,000,000 years, humans are probably going to be closer to the way I would think of a god today. And I'm going to be like, so who's to say they relate to time in the same way we relate to time? You know, they might be watching over you, you know, rewarding you when you do things that make the future of our species better and punishing you when you do things that make the future of our species worse. And we say the way they punish you is very interesting. It's actually coded into your genes, which is when you try to live a hedonistic life, all pleasure turns to sand in your mouth. You don't actually gain meaningful pleasure from anything other than efficaciously living your value system. And this, I think, is true of people. Like, we're telling them a true thing. It's the way things would have been coded, you know, if this entity existed. And so they're like, oh, that's plausible. But we also, within the Judeo-Christian tree, we talk about something called a tesseract god. Tesseract god means you can think of God as sort of like a four-dimensional shape projecting a shadow within three-dimensional space. We have a video on this. Like, we are not capable of fully understanding the concept of God in the same way that we are not capable of even imagining what a four-dimensional shape looks like. And because of this, most conservative traditions, what they're seeing are, a few of the conservative traditions, not all of them, but a few of them are total full revelations from God insofar as humans of that time period could understand God. And so when you start to try to average these shapes, you actually get if you were trying to average a cube shadow, you would think that the cube was actually a sphere. And it's like, no, you're actually probably better at either understanding the concept of three-dimensional space when you're looking at a two-dimensional plane, or just going with whatever is being fully projected, because that is a full revelation of what that cube is. So we think things like, you know, the Protestant faith, for example, is one totally and complete full revelation from within that time period. But that time period was 2,000 years ago. And humans today have much more understanding and much greater capability of understanding God than a bunch of humans living in a desert 2,000 years ago. And it was the same when he revealed himself, you know, before that, you know, to the Jewish people, right? That was a complete revelation insofar as they could understand it at that time period. You know, like we talk about the Ark story. He probably was trying to convey something that was real and true to them, but it was like trying to convey it to an idiotic child. And he just got frustrated and was like, yes, it was a big boat and all the animals were on it. There probably was some sort of a flood event. There probably was some sort of a meaningful Ark story. And this story was told because it was meant to convey something that even today we can go back and study and try to understand what it was trying to tell us. But it wasn't literally an Ark. So this is the way that we sort of interpret this. And it's the way that we fix out the local revelation problem, in that we say that all people have been given a full revelation insofar as they are capable of understanding it, or the full revelation that they're meant to get. And it's your duty to intergenerationally improve yourself so that future generations are capable of understanding and digesting a fuller revelation of God.
So here's my concern about a tradition that would have too much emphasis on progressive revelation. It seems like part of the problem is that really, the problem with the urban monoculture and declining fertility rates is a lack of fidelity to intergenerational faithfulness and sort of an increase in looking at only my generation or myself and pleasing myself in the now, as opposed to making some sacrifices where, okay, if I'm going to have five kids, that means there's going to be a lot of money going to these kids and to savings accounts for their education, all sorts of stuff like that. And I can't maybe take as fun of vacations because I have to, like, you know, vacationing with a large family is somewhat difficult, right? Okay, so I'm having to make all of these sacrifices if I'm going to be having more children. And so there's this tug between I should just indulge myself or I should submit my own temporary short-term desires to this larger thing. But I feel like the conservative traditions that are like, you need to submit to this big thing. And this big thing is carrying a lot of the weight of helping repress, you know, short-term impulse and hedonism and stuff like that. Whereas if you open that up too much, if you have too much open revelation or too much change, it'll be so hard for the change not to be tugged in a hedonistic.
You're right. And we've thought about this. We've worked on systems within it. So I think that there is a misunderstanding that the What's toxic about the urban monoculture is just a walking away from traditions. What's toxic about them is what they're maximizing around, which is reduction of suffering. It's not really hedonism that they're maximizing around. They're maximizing around never having to hear or say anything that even momentarily causes emotional or physical discomfort.
One generation at a time, right? Not, it's like, we're not trying to minimize multi-generational suffering. We're trying to minimize my own personal suffering.
Well, no. Even within a generation, it's in the moment suffering. This is why you have things like the Hayes movement, right? Where it's now offensive to tell a fat person it's unhealthy to be fat and it will cause you more pain in the long term. Because that causes pain in the short term as opposed to, so they're completely optimized around this. And where they carve systems and make it easier, it's tied to that. But also there's a level of status hierarchy around hedonism within them. Culture is the way that you judge status within a culture is really important to the direction that culture moves. And so the way that we do this is with a system called the index, where in the same way that capitalism sort of utilizes human greed to maintain human productivity and sort of kindness in a way, we try to do something similar with our religious system, where we tell our kids, well, intergenerationally, it is your religious duty to attempt to improve the system. So this means change up holidays, you know, add a different theological formats, but you get to record in the central index, which is a book or like a cloud protocol, basically, how you think we did as parents, how many kids we ended up having, and how those kids, you know, stayed in the faith, how many kids they ended up having, their economic potential. But your kids are going to judge you, and they're going to judge you against your own ancestors. So between generations, you have a focus on the ultimate core goal is intergenerational improvement. The number of kids you have who stay within the faith, the larger faith structure. And finally, sort of a control of one's basal impulses. So we would call this hedonism, but it's more than hedonism. It's the ability to allow the human side of you. Like we say that humans are composed of two sides. It's the animal side and the human side. The animal side is all of the things that are genetically pre-programmed into you, whether that's suffering or happiness or anything like that. And we see indulging in any of those as a sign of sin and as a human recursing to the animalistic state. To the extent where we see things like indulging in love as a sin, indulging in happiness as a sin, indulging in, expanded consciousness experience with like hallucinogenics is a sin. We are really strict around this particular framework within our tradition. So while we encourage a level of intergenerational improvement, it's still all focused around the same end goal. Now, a lot of people will say, yeah, but a system that's banning certain behaviors is going to do better than this system. Like historically, like Catholicism did this really well, for example, by just banning things that would prevent you from having procreative sex with your wife, like porn and contraception and stuff like this. Or within Judaism, they'll go even further. Like you can't have sex with your wife when you're menstruating because she's not fertile at that stage, basically. And the iterations that had these practices had more kids than the iterations that didn't. And it's like, yes, this will reduce the fertility rate among the lower IQ people within our cultural tradition and the lower impulse control people within our cultural tradition. But that's also kind of the point, because we're optimizing for something different than what cultures were optimizing for historically, which is intergenerational improvement and not just maxing out our fertility rates or...
And there's a new self-awareness about what's going on that needs to happen. Like a lot of these super old traditions, they might not have understood how some of these things in their religion were helping them in these intergenerational impulse control sort of ways. It was just sort of the thing that you did. And there were maybe reasons given that were, you know, theological or mythological in nature, but weren't like, you know, the practical perhaps reason given. Yeah, and now the new religions need to be self-aware of what they're doing and still and not have that cause a deconstructive effect, but a constructive effect.
Exactly. Yeah. We point out that almost every long living cultural tradition has some sort of arbitrary self-denial ritual, whether it's Ramadan or Lent or Feast of the Firstborn. And now, you know, my background's in neuroscience. We know that this likely strengthens the inhibitory pathways in the prefrontal cortex that makes it easier to shut down intrusive thoughts and have larger impulse control. Like now we understand why we were doing that, but a lot of people didn't know why they needed to know impulse control. Mm-hmm. And so they just had these arbitrary traditions. I mean, religions figured out hand washing literally centuries before science figured out why hand washing was important. And so, Yeah, you're absolutely. But now you can't just say do it because this is the thing we've always done. That doesn't work anymore. And people are like, but then you lose the religious aspect. And I'm like, man, you have not seen our family. Like, people are like, you constructed this religion. How can you also believe this religion? That's like, well, because we think that God inspired us to construct it in this way. And we really believe that. And they're like, why? It's like, well, when you start practicing rituals, when you start engaging with a religion in this way, you're almost as a human sort of pre-programmed to believe it, as long as there's not a strong reason to plausibly doubt either its ethical nature or its efficacy. And when we talk about its ethical nature, this is one thing that is causing a lot of problems when you talk about like LGBT rights and stuff like that, right? Like, this is clearly one of the most effective wedge issues that the urban monoculture is using to split people out of old, long-lasting cultural traditions. And they can use it against any long-lasting cultural tradition because every single successful long-lasting cultural tradition in human history has had an underlying kernel of homophobia. Why? Because that increased fertility rates and caused those cultural groups to outcompete other cultural groups. Yeah. But today, it seems capricious and weird. And there are people who are like, well, why would God, you know, code all of that?
I mean, it is sexual activity for reproduction, or is it for self-indulgence? That's exactly what the LGBT stuff is
touching. Oh, yeah. Well, but Christian aspects, like, they can be a conservative Christian aspect and accidentally pick up on this. So we have an episode that's Girl Defined Ruined an Entire Generation of Women, take off of the Scott Pilgrim song. And Girl Defined, if people don't know it, it's a conservative Christian station, right? Like podcast. And these girls, they created this ideal that if you were chaste and you waited till marriage, then you would get extra good sex. Like, sex was extra good and extra amazing if you followed all the Christian rules.
A lot of millennials that grew up in evangelical culture will know this, that sex is extra good on your wedding night if you were chaste.
Yeah, and that shows a fall from the face because they didn't understand the purpose of these rules. And the girls who grew up doing this, Girl Defined, their relationships are terrible. Their sex life is terrible. They seem miserable these days. And the answer is, like, why did this happen to them? Because they were fighting for the wrong thing. They should have always fought for hedonic supplication. They should have known that sex and sexual pleasure was never the point. Not on your marriage night, not after your marriage night. Love was never the point. Duty to the divine, duty to a higher order was the point. Supplication to the higher order was always the point. But personal hedonism? No. And so what they learned is following the old traditions is not a path to outcompete the urban monoculture at what the urban monoculture is offering. If you want ash on your tongue hedonism, if you want, you know, Midas gold, you can get that, right? But it won't genuinely ever fulfill you because pleasure thought for its own sake is never fulfilling. Pleasure that you get as a side effect from efficaciously living your values is the only pleasure that can actively satisfy a human being. And God created us that way. That's our belief, at least.
Yeah. Because it's connected with meaning and purpose and it stacks together as opposed to it just being isolated from its meaning and purpose.
Yeah. I mean, something like sex. I mean, people would say, oh, your wife and you must have like a terrible. And it's like, yeah, but every time like we're looking at doing something like sex, we're like, are there other more efficacious tasks we could be working on right now? Like, the world is literally burning around us. Do we have the time to burn on a purely hedonistic activity? And the answer is often no. And people are like, oh, I don't know, that sounds terrible. And it's like, well, no, it's because we live for something that we think has value. And if you're not asking yourself those types of questions all the time, am I working on something that actually matters for like the future of humanity, for God, for things that are true? Or am I doing something that is just meant for in the moment happiness? If there isn't something more important in your life than in the moment happiness, then your life is going to be very barren.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a question from one person trying to engineer a religion for his family to another. How do you find other people for your kids to marry? Because one of these things that religions have always served is a group where your kids can find other people to marry. And so if you're making a new one, the problem is that you don't have that other, that pre-built community for your kids to find spouses
in. Yeah, I'm going to have to hop off in just a second, but we're doing arranged marriages for our kids. Is the answer. And we're creating a network of diverse religious structures of people trying this. So you should reach out to us and you can join the Central Index if you're interested, which we discuss how it works in the Pragmatist Guide to Crafting Religion. And yeah, the idea is we create a network of families. We do like retreats, similar to how ultra-Orthodox Jews do, where like we have summer camps and stuff like that. So the kids can all meet each other. They know the other weird kids. And we also work off of some other databases, like other kids who are genetically selected, like some of our kids are. So we can have these be intergenerational practices with our families who are doing weird sorts of traditions like this. And I think it'll be effective because the families that I've seen that have opted into this are generally like really productive individuals and high fertility. Like it's a trend that's going around. Most of them just aren't as loud as we are because it creates, you know, ridicule.
Yeah. All right. Well, Malcolm, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great to chat with you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.